In this episode, you'll learn when calling DCF protects your child and when it could backfire.
Welcome to Women Winning Divorce, the podcast helping successful women navigate divorce with dignity so you can protect yourself, your children, and your assets. I'm Heather Quick, founding attorney at Florida Women's Law Group, where women win at life.
This week, we had Robin Sachs on the show, and we had a great conversation about when to involve DCF and when not to, protecting your children in high conflict situations and smarter ways to communicate with your co-parent. I hope this episode is valuable to anyone who might be listening. Stay tuned for the full episode. Welcome to this week's episode of Women Winning Divorce. I'm Heather Quick, owner and attorney at Florida Women's Law Group. Today, Robin Sachs is joining us. Robin is a seasoned attorney and clinical therapist specializing in helping families and individuals navigate the complex terrain where criminal and family law and mental health intersect. Today, Robin and I will be discussing when to involve DCFS or DCF and when not to, protecting your children in high conflict situations, and smarter ways to communicate with your co-parent. Welcome, Robin.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm so excited to have you. And I know that our listeners are going to enjoy this as well. So for our listeners, though, would you share a little bit about yourself and how you got to become an attorney and a therapist and all your other things? It's amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. I tell people all the time, I'm a lawyer and a therapist. And in some ways, I'm both. In some ways, I'm neither. my background comes from, I was a prosecutor in the area of child sexual assault and domestic violence for many, many years. And I was always right next door to family law, dependency, welfare, which I know we're going to talk about. And I worked on multidisciplinary teams, interviewing kids, forensic interviews in cases of abuse. So I kind of always was like a fake therapist, if you will. Yeah. And then got into doing a lot more work in the family law area and decided, you know, even though I could probably do what I wanted to do without necessarily being credentialed, I wanted to make sure I knew the ins and outs of therapeutic concepts, different disciplines. I worked as a therapist and an outpatient psych ward and an inpatient psych ward. I've done a lot of work in the therapeutic space and I'm licensed. And so I have a truly blended practice. There are some people who are lawyers turned therapists or therapists turned lawyers. Mm-hmm. I really have a very integrated practice where I use principles of both.
Wow. Well, that's amazing. You are the first person that I have ever met who is doing both. And it's such a good match. I mean, honestly, those two professions are so, you know, just symbiotic and so helpful. I have no doubt for your clients and anybody else contact with on these difficult family law issues.
Yeah, I tell people all the time that underneath every legal issue is probably some sort of mental health issue. And if there wasn't one to begin with, there's one after because of the stress, the anxiety, the depression, if there's substance abuse, alcohol abuse, family issues, everything, there's really that intersection. And we hear that in the news and in everywhere else. And I really am trying to take that integrated approach.
Well, I love to hear it. That's amazing. So let's jump right into it. For listeners who may not be familiar, what exactly is DCFS or DCF, and what is their role?
So a lot of different jurisdictions have different names for what child welfare services are. So there's DCFS. A lot of people are familiar with CPS, DCF, depending on what jurisdiction you're in. It's the agency. So in California or in Los Angeles, it's known as DCFS, which is the Department of Children and Family Services, CPS. Same type of agency as Child Protective Services. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of variations in that. What it basically is that governmental agency that is in charge of protecting children and investigating allegations of abuse or neglect. And they're all about child welfare.
Now, what typically needs to happen for one of those agencies, the DCFS, to get involved in a custody or divorce situation?
Well, so there's a variety of different ways that DCFS or CPS might get involved in a case. And it doesn't mean that there's a family law case either. So just so people know that there are many, many cases where there are intact families that DCFS could get involved in your life. So that's probably even more of those than necessarily family law cases. But whenever there is a suspicion that there is abuse of neglect of a child, most states, all states, have some sort of mandated reporting laws. So a case could get reported through a teacher, a doctor, a therapist, or any other type of mandated reporter who might be out there, and they make a report and the case can get into the system that way. There's also no requirement that it only comes in through a mandated reporter. There are hotlines in every county for suspected child abuse that come in from non-mandated reporters, neighbors, observers, parents, people, step-parents, whomever, or not mandated may make a report. Sometimes that becomes at the suggestion of a lawyer or a well-intended friend or a family member or whomever else. But those are the two general buckets of how cases get into the system as it happens.
Yeah. Now, and let's talk about maybe some common misconceptions people have about when you involve these agents.
Well, so, you know, this is one of those situations that a lot of people kind of do things, but don't necessarily play out the unintended consequences that may end up happening. So, you know, there are, you know, first of all, any person, and I'm not talking about the mandated reports parts, because in the mandated, there's not much you can control, but people sometimes do strategically try to relay instances of abuse to a mandated reporter, which would trigger a mandated reporter to make a mandated report. So for example, I have seen, we've all heard about it, right? Like a parent goes to a therapist, tells the therapist about an incident, and then now that therapist is a mandated reporter who will have to report. Sometimes that's done intentionally. Sometimes it's done unintentionally. And so we have to be very cognizant. I always tell people, whenever we say something, especially if there's a family law case, you have to think about what your goal is, right? Like, you know, you can't kind of go at these things of, I just want to test the waters, or I just want to let someone know, but I don't want them to really do anything. Once you actually do the things that triggers a report, the train has left the station and the parent and the people involved have zero actual control of what happens next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. Over the years that I have cautioned individuals, you know, I'm like, be careful bringing the government into your situation. They're very, very appropriate times and they do a great service and they have a job to do, but be very careful if that is something that rises to that level, you know, and trying to help, you know, individuals with that, like, because, all right, like, you know, your child's at your husband's house and say, you know, that he's not brushing her hair, it's all tangly, and like they just get to eat, you know, junk food for dinner. I really feel like, you know, that's neglect and I should call the Department of Children.
Yes.
Would be your response to that?
Well, so first of all, there's a couple of things. First of all, I don't know, at least here, I don't think a DCFS would take that report in our jurisdiction. So maybe that's a not high risk type of example in terms of someone opening the door. By the way, that is something that a lot of hotlines can do, is you can do a consult with DCFS of it without giving the information. You can call and say, if I heard about this, would this be something that you would take a report about? And you can actually get a consult with them without actually reporting. Mm. So you have an ability to do kind of a soft report. So in the example you gave, I don't think that would be enough information that would get, at least not in Los Angeles, certainly wouldn't get DCFS very interested. Now, if it was a school that was calling and said, little Johnny comes to school every day and doesn't have lunch with him, and I've asked and his hair's all matted, and I've sent a note to the parents, and I'm concerned that this kid isn't getting properly fed, that is something that I could see DCFS taking action. But I think that we have to be careful also. I mean, you know, we talk about this all the time. It's like, what feels like abuse or what feels like neglect, and is it actually neglect, right? Mm-hmm. Like, is that actually something that's going to be? Now, for the purposes of mandated reporting, there's no duty of any mandated reporter to actually know if whatever is occurring is occurring. They just have to have a reasonable suspicion. So if the reasonable suspicion is the hair is matty and the lunch isn't being served and they really believe or have a reasonable suspicion that there's neglect going on, then that would be a good basis. But if it was a parent calling and just making yeah. that kind of complaint, I don't know that DCFS would feel like that rises to reasonable suspicion.
Yeah, I agree. Now, what, let's, for our listeners, you know, what should they do if, say, their co-parent or spouse, maybe they're separated, whatever, threatens to call the DCF on them? You know, how do we advise people to respond to that? Because that can be really scary. Obviously, kind of like fighting words, you know, can really incite a lot of feelings. But, you know, what would you advise somebody to do in that situation?
Well, first of all, it's always interesting to me when there's like the threat that tells you a lot, right? Because like if you are the person who really believes that abuse is going on, the last thing you want to do is tip off the other parent. So if you are the person that there's abuse going on, don't threaten to tell.
Right.
But don't say, I'm going to call DCFS on you. Call DCFS, right? Yeah. If you think abuse is happening and you believe that it's legitimate, you do not want to tell the other person that you might do it, because now that person is going to prepare, they've been tipped off, and that affects the integrity of an investigation. So I don't ever think that threatening is ever a good thing. A lot of times when someone threatens, that's actually a very helpful thing to the person who's being threatened, right? Go ahead, call DCFS. Because that's going to backfire usually on the person that is making that threat. It's a projection, it's an abusive tactic. And the idea is to scare, you know, don't let that goal get accomplished. Obviously, if there's something, you know, and the tricky situations are there things that I've done that I am actually a little bit worried about DCFS knowing? So like, for example, someone saying, I'm going to call DCFS because you let Johnny get in the car, you know, drive in the car without a car seat. And you did let Johnny drive in the car without a car seat. Like it's a threat, but you did what is kind of a little scary. Right. I think in a situation like that, you don't give that person the benefit of any response and say, you know, the response to them is you'll do what you need to do. And what you need to do as the person receiving the threat is get on the phone with the lawyer right away. And I would also make sure in a lot of jurisdiction, there are different lawyers that practice welfare, child welfare law, dependency law versus family law lawyers. And I highly recommend speaking to someone who specifically does dependency and child welfare, because it's a different animal than family court.
Yes, it is so different here. I mean, completely different. In our practice, I did some like years and years ago, but we do not. We immediately are like, no, you need to be involved with somebody who is practicing, because then, you know, and just for our listeners, right, you know, usually the folks that are in there, and they're just a few judges assigned to those areas, and they know all the players, right, the guardian ad litems, the various attorneys, the judges, and it is, it's a whole different system that's so very important that you've got the right attorney in there on your side who 100%. Understands.
And that goes also for criminal, right, because so a lot of times the very same action, particularly you see this in child abuse or domestic violence, but the same exact set of facts could play out in three different courtrooms, right? So you could have in a family law courtroom getting a restraining order. You could have in dependency or in child welfare, you could have them seeking parental ramifications, removal of a child, child welfare. You could also see the criminal justice system involved in prosecution. And so most lawyers are not trilingual in all three of those areas. And a lot of them do not realize that, you know, you start talking to the police, that's going to play out.
Yeah.
You know, that could have criminal ramifications, that could have dependency ramifications. So you really need to speak to the right specialists in the areas. And my always suggestion, I'm a huge advocate of team collaborative type of work as professionals. And, you know, it's a big red flag when you have an attorney that says, I can do everything. Don't talk to anybody else. I got it. Like that says to me, like your practice isn't that busy.
That is exactly what I was thinking. Yes. Don't run from that, because they're all so very complex and really need to have hopefully more of a collaborative approach for sure. All right. Now let's talk about when a situation actually becomes dangerous for children legally. And from a child development.
In terms of contacting DCFS?
Yeah, like when, you know, what are some things, you know, especially like between legally, and I know it varies, like that's a really broad question, right? Because we do, you know, on their developmental skills, different. But let's just talk about younger children, because I think that's where I think on one hand it's common sense, but and people rely on, you know, what they've done in the past. But here's a good example. I was going to say leaving a child home alone, but like with the older child. But, you know, I think everybody, you know, probably has their own definition of when it's okay to leave the kids alone, but like legally, you know, you could, you know, I'm sure get yourself in trouble and it can be dangerous.
That's a really good, you're really good with the tricky hypos. I like them. You're challenging my thinking brain. That's great. let's back into this a little bit.
Okay.
Let's talk about the easy calls, right?
Okay.
Where someone is, where a crime has been committed. A kid has been hit, bruised, sexually assaulted, witnessed domestic violence, anything that is what would amount to criminal behavior. Number one suggestion, you're calling the police, okay? Mm-hmm. The police are required to cross report to the Department of Children and Family Services and let them go. So if there's anything that is criminal, that should be called to the police first so that you can get immediate intervention and then they will begin the process with DCFS. So that's like the clear cut cases. Someone has been hit, hurt, abused, you know, abandoned in any way, you know, very clear, you know, violation of a restraining order, any of those types of things, law enforcement should be called. In things that are not criminal, so, for example, it's not necessarily against the law, per se, to leave a child at home. So that would not be criminal. And that's kind of one of those judgment calls. I think the thing is that you really need to look at, you know, I think consulting with somebody. You can consult with, by the way, therapists in a hypothetical format. You could say, listen, if I were to tell you about someone like this, so you're not disclosing and therefore triggering the mandated report, you can get some consultation from a professional. And things like leaving home alone are going to be dependent on a bunch of factors, the age of the child, the maturity of the child, the danger or what circumstances are, you know, in the home. So, for example, like, you know, is generally thought of as kids can be left alone at about age 11, 12 in LA. That's kind of the general rule. It's not written anywhere. But if you have an 11-year-old who's developmentally disabled or in a wheelchair, no, that kid can't be left alone, right? If there's no food in the house and the parent's gone, there's a big difference being gone for 10, 15 minutes versus being gone for 10 or 15 hours, right?
Yeah.
It's, you know, you have to look at kind of it's a gestalt, kind of a whole bunch of circumstances. And I think that if there's a question, you should consult someone. The other thing is if you're the person doing it, if you are asking yourself, I'm wondering if this is okay. It probably is not okay.
Don't do it. Yeah, exactly.
You're opening the doors for, especially if you have a litigant on the other side who's eager to just pounce on you.
Yeah.
Don't do the don't step into the traps because the other person's going to take it.
Right. And also, I think just, you know, for our listeners, because I know you know this, Robin, and we tell our clients this all the time, right? Okay, you're not operating now anymore as like a family unit and doing things that, you know, you both agree on or you're both okay with. Like now things are in a microscope and very often it can be taken out of context. And right. And like the lawyer's going to point out that you know, late on the last like three well visits or they're behind on their vaccinations, you know, their booster or whatever. And things that maybe in a normal situation, okay, you're just a little bit overwhelmed, like you're getting there, but in litigation with a litigant on the other side or whatever's going on, like things sometimes can be blown up a little bit or part of a bigger picture that they're trying to show. So it's just be careful, be smart, like you said, right? If you're questioning it, then don't do it. Don't do it.
If you think your ex is a jerk, then expect for them to play gotcha. And if you tell people all the time, like, we can't control the jerk, but we can control the times that they get us. And if we just do what we're supposed to do, worry about your side of the street, keep it clean or whatever. And by the way, like, if you're the person that's like realized, oh my God, I'm running late for the wellness, that's the time to write the OFW or the talking parent that says, hey, I know that we have a wellness that's whatever due, but due to scheduling, I'm not going to be able to make it until this date. And so by communicating, you're going to negate the, okay, so it's late, but you at least said something.
Right.
It doesn't look like
you're aware.
You were not forgetful. I mean, a lot of the co-parenting techniques is, you know, executive functioning, right? Being organized, being on top of it, advanced planning, communicating. You know, you have to look at this from a business perspective and you can mitigate a lot of problems with good communication.
Indeed. All right. Let's talk a little bit about some signs or behaviors that should raise red flags for abuse or neglect.
Okay, well, the easy category are any physical marks, anything that you would see. Now, I also would caution people, like, one of the things that I see happen is, you know, people, like, you know, there's an exchange. Kid comes back home from the other parent's house, and the other parent does a head-to-toe photographic expose of that person. That mm-hmm. could be called abuse, just doing that. Yeah. So, you know, you're not sitting here doing, you know, take off your clothes, let me look at you from head to toe, an examination. Unless there's, if there's really a belief that something's going on or things don't make sense, you know, maybe going to a pediatrician and going to an appointment is a good idea. And, but not sitting here doing that. I mean, I actually had a case where I had a father who was taking pictures of the child's bowel movements every day to show that the shape and consistency must mean that the mother doesn't feed the kid healthy food. And I'm like, the fact that you take pictures of bowel movements tells me that I'm concerned that you're abusive. So wow. I'd be careful about that. The other thing is obviously changes in behavior, statements mm-hmm. that kids make. I do not recommend ever for parents to be the one to interview, interrogate, tape record, and do all of the stuff. Right. It's gonna, you know, you have to be very careful to not, you know, appear suggestive or coaching or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I mean, one of the kind of what I tell parents that what we should be saying to kids all the time is if anybody's ever hurting you, and I'm talking anybody, right?
Yeah.
Teacher, you know, the caregivers,
coaches, friends, whatever, like, anybody,
whatever. Yeah. Kids should be taught that they need to tell someone and tell mm-hmm. someone until someone does something. And I also set it up that the telling person is not necessarily the parent. I know that a lot of us, listen, I have a daughter. Mm-hmm. I would love it if my daughter came to me first if something happened. But I've set it up where I've said to my daughter when she was really little, like, if anything ever happened and you didn't feel safe telling me, like, Aunt Heather is a great person to talk to. Aunt Heather mm-hmm. is a safe person to talk to. Or your teacher is a safe person to talk to. Because if mm-hmm. you get kids to be able to tell a mandated reporter or someone that they feel safe reporting to, that can be very helpful.
That's really smart. I never would have thought about that. Like, you know, you can, these are people you can talk to as well, just giving them an option.
Right. And I really try to teach kids how to advocate for themselves by, just like at school, like if a kid's bothering you and you tell the teacher and they don't do anything, then tell another teacher. Tell the mm-hmm. counselor, tell the principal, tell until someone does something.
Yeah, that is good advice. Now, let's talk, I mean, what kind of evidence is necessary to prove that abuse or neglect is actually occurring? Because I know it can be very difficult.
It is really, really difficult. And again, a lot of times the level of proof, although there are standards of proof in court, it's based on, you know, sometimes a lot of subjective information, mm-hmm. right? So there's, you know, and by the way, it should be known that in the family law system and then the child welfare system and the criminal system, there are three different standards of proof, okay? Mm-hmm. So what is provable for, quote, abuse in family law is different than what would qualify in welfare, child welfare, and different than what would apply in mm-hmm. criminal cases. So what you will see is there's, you know, kind of a crescendo, right? The higher the level of proof that's required to prove the allegations, the more that you're going to need to be able to substantiate mm-hmm. what that is. In family courts, it's usually preponderance of the evidence, right? So you just need slightly more evidence than not. By the time you get right. to child welfare, it's generally clear and convincing evidence. Mm-hmm. And then in criminal justice, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. So the level of what you need, usually one person's account or one person's word, generally, I'm not saying never, is usually not going to be enough mm-hmm. to bring about abuse allegations in either dependency or in criminal. Usually you're going to need some sort of corroboration. Now, corroboration comes in a lot of forms. I do a lot of training in law enforcement and social workers on how to find corroboration. Corroboration doesn't, you know, a lot of people think corroboration means that there needs to be scientific evidence or DNA or a videotape or audio tape. Those are great. That's great if you have all of that. Not, you know, most child molesters don't molest people with a camera rolling. Most, you know, a lot. It's tricky. This is tricky stuff. But sometimes corroboration is in, you know, the credibility of who it was, something was reported to, the circumstances, the demeanor, the number of victims with multiple victims, statements made by a variety of people that place people at a certain place, also lies by one party. So credibility becomes very helpful or not helpful, depending, right? So for example, if I'm being accused and I say I was in France at the time this incident happened, and then there's a picture of me in San Francisco, and that's where the crime occurred, that's going to corroborate the person who's telling point of view more than my point of view, right? So there's all kinds of different ways to get corroboration.
And I agree with you that, you know, I talk to our clients, my attorneys all the time. You know, we don't go into court with he said, she said. We got to have more. There's got to be more, because so much can happen, and we're depending on a judge in family law court to make a decision, and you need a little bit more, generally speaking. Again, I like how you explained the crescendo, and it's also because usually the level of which you're asking, or the, you know, punishment, the consequences are just also in a crescendo different. And so that's why the level of proof gets higher. And, you know, there are things in family law court that, you know, can be enough to order counseling, drug testing, and usually further things that may lead to, you know, a suspension of your time sharing. But it builds like that. And I thought that was a great explanation, especially for our listeners, because sometimes something might happen and they really don't know, right? Like, where is it this going to be appropriately heard? So how do they, I mean, obviously they need to talk to a lawyer, but when should a criminal attorney be brought into?
Well, I mean, there's no downside if you think that there's something criminal to have a consultation with a criminal lawyer who can then direct you where that line is and what that would be, what would be needed. The other thing is, I think a lot of people don't realize that there's a, you know, there's criminal defense attorneys, right? People who represent people accused of crimes, but there's also Marcy's law attorneys, which are victims' rights lawyers who help people navigate the criminal justice system from a victim point of view. And that, you know, those people can be very helpful in at least identifying when something should be brought to the police or what to do after it's been brought to the police. The other thing is, by the way, on the reverse side, a lot of people don't call criminal defense attorneys until after, like, the police are knocking at the door with the warning. You think the police can be involved? You can consult a criminal defense attorney at any time, and you should have them. If you think that you have a potential of being accused of a crime ever, you should know who your criminal defense attorney is, and have the person on speed dial to be able to consult with should that become necessary at any time. But I think that, you know, so one way is to be able to consult with the lawyer. The other thing is to also, therapists can be helpful in terms of consulting, but it's also like the general PU test, right? Like, if you feel that there's an escalation of things and you think that things are crossing a line of danger or criminal or abuse, that should be a time that's telling you something.
Yeah. And I think sometimes our clients and individuals who are involved, certainly in a family law case that is contentious or high conflict, they forget that, right? Because they feel like everything is so altered and some things get blown out of proportion and the judge didn't care. And they lose their sense of, you know, that intuition. They feel like maybe it's not right, but you know, you got to kind of go back to that and something feel off. And at least, like you said, take some steps to talk to somebody, a professional that can give you some guidance.
Yeah. And I think in this day and age, I mean, we have to be really careful, because a lot of times you kind of only have one shot to be able to make your case. And so one of the biggest problems I see is that people just start calling DCFS or start making these reports, and they come to me and it's now the seventh or eighth report and they've already kind of been poo-pooed by the system and hasn't gotten traction. And that's because maybe they weren't very strategic in their original reporting and they get then kind of, you know, conceptualized as being a false reporter or whatever else that's going on, and it doesn't go very well. So I really think I work a lot in my practice with kind of coaching people of how and when a case is ready to report, right? Like, when, let's find, you know, let's get this out of he said, she said. So for example, I'll work with clients about how to write strategic OFWs about situations that may be kind of murky as to what occurred, but you know, to see if you can get any statements from the other person that can then help bolster an understanding. Like, I'm so confused, you know, dear ex, I'm so confused. Johnny came home and, you know, was wearing a really heavy jacket, you know, in July. Can you help me understand why you sent him home with that? Now, so to me, as a sex crimes prosecutor, a kid wearing a very heavy jacket, is there hiding something underneath that jacket? Right. Okay. And so something's going on. That's weird, right? A kid wouldn't be wearing a ski jacket in July, especially if you're in a hot place, right? So, but instead of saying, I know you abused him and what's going on, writing as something very innocuous of help me understand, that's so confusing. Any response to that can be very helpful, because number one, if the it's establishing that that event happened.
Okay,
number two, you're asking an open-ended question, and any statement is going to lock that other person into what the facts were on that date, as opposed to you just writing some sort of mental note of what happened and somebody saying, well, why didn't you say something about that sign then? Now you've said something. Now, is that enough for abuse? No. But is that enough for me to be curious that abuse may be going on? So then you have a few of these communications. You start putting those together. Then a disclosure happens. And now you've got a real nice corroboration packet.
Yeah. And that's how you build a case. You just got, you got to keep doing one at a time and being strategic about it. Like you said, I love that. Now, you wear multiple hats in your practice, therapist, a lawyer, and a strategist. Can you explain how that integrated approach helps families more holistically?
So just, I do not do any family law lawyering.
Okay.
The only kind of lawyering I act as a lawyer, so I try to make my practice really clear so it doesn't create confusion for people. So as a lawyer, I only do criminal.
Okay.
I only will do Marcy's law and a small amount of criminal defense. The other part of my practice, which is the family law practice, if you will, is all the family law adjacent services. So I'm a mediator, I'm an individual coach, or I'll work with people individually, like as a consulting lawyer. I don't like to call myself a lawyer, but I am. But you know, as a consultant, as a strategist working on a team, I do parenting plan coordination. I act as a PPC, which some jurisdictions know that as being a special master. So I get appointed by the court to make recommendations. I do co-parenting counseling. I work sometimes individually behind the scenes where people don't know about me. So I'll prep people for custody evals, or I'll help them with their communications, or I'll do that. Sometimes I'm a individual coach in front of the scenes, working with guardians ad litem, letting them know that I'm there. I'm working on, sometimes I have to do a little reputation rehab with people who are appear to be problem litigants that we need to clean up. So I will help clean people up and get their bad behavior dealt with. Also work with people who are in situations like you're talking about, where it's, you know, we may not have enough for an abuse claim yet, but we know that something's there, and trying to assist in ghostwriting or doing things to pull that stuff out. So I do all of those kinds of ancillary family law services.
That is so cool. I really think so, especially the strategist part, because, you know, and I would imagine many family law lawyers, other lawyers are like, you need to go see Robin. Like, you, that's who you need to spend time with from that angle to then help you if you want to succeed, you know, in the courtroom. Because that's amazing.
Absolutely.
There's so much strategy and in what's necessary to, if they want to really achieve, you know, specific goals.
Absolutely. And a lot of times it's also kind of coaching people on how to deal with their lawyers, right? Because sometimes difficult people don't get along with their lawyer, and I have to kind of help be the bridge there. So I work with a lot of the lawyers too. And, you know, knowing the different personalities of lawyers, or what certain lawyers like or looking for, knowing what certain judges like or looking for, kind of coaching people to navigate their case. And I try to do it in a way where, you know, I'm, you know, like a associate almost of the lawyer, you know, because I tell people all the time that in a tie between what I say and what a lawyer says, their lawyer wins. I don't want to create confusion. However, I generally am on the same page. And if I'm confused with why a lawyer is suggesting something, I just get on the phone with the lawyer. I'm like, okay, am I missing something? You know, this is what I'm thinking. And it's, and sometimes it takes me a minute to get to know the personalities of the lawyers. But the more communication, we're trying to model communication, collaboration, working together. And that's how I run my practice.
Well, I think that's fascinating. And with the parenting plan coordination, I mean, there's a huge need for that. So are you, do you sit as a special master? And for our listeners, my interpretation of that is kind of like a hearing officer, but somebody who is going to make a recommendation to the court and find out really what's going on both sides. And then, you know, what in the children and their, you know, best interests, I would imagine. Is that more of the parenting plan part, or do you do any working with people together to help them come to, you know, some parenting plan?
So parenting plan coordination. California is weird.
Okay.
California has this thing and it's called PPC, which is the same as most people's special masters. So It is actually a quasi-judicial process where I have the ability to actually make my recommendations can turn into court orders. Mm-hmm. I file them with the court. They get signed off by the court. There's a method by which they can object or challenge my orders. But there's something that it's a decision-making process. And usually those are in high conflict cases. Mm-hmm. Although some even lower conflict people or no conflict people want to have me in place to like, okay, if we can't agree, then let's just ask Robin. And so there's certain protocols. I have a very systematic way of hearing from both sides. I talk to therapists, kids. You know, I had a case with orthodontists. I need to talk to the orthodontist or a pediatric dentist or teachers or counselors or grandparents or step-parents. I'll talk to whoever I need to talk to. And sometimes they're really easy recommendations like, oh, we want to change the location from drop-off at McDonald's to drop-off at Starbucks, right? And so then I'm like, okay, we're going to do this, right? Or, you know, can the kid celebrate their birthday at camp? One parent doesn't want the kid to go to their birthday at camp. The other, who wants to file in a here? Like, I'm just going to make that decision for them, right? That's a 5-minute thing. It saves a lot of money, a lot of time. Not necessarily 5 minutes. Maybe it's 50 minutes, but it's a short, it does not take.
Shorter than months that it would take to go to court.
Yes, exactly. Or, you know, we can't decide between this camp and that camp or this school and that school, or should they have 2 hours of tutoring a week or, you know, 5 hours of tutoring a week, or should they do Cub Scouts or should they do baseball? Can they be on the traveling baseball team or can they not be on the traveling baseball team? Can they have a sleepover? Can they get their ears pierced? Can they get an iPhone? Can they get a watch? Who's paying for it? All these things that happen, can we cut their hair? How much can we cut their hair? You know, all the things that you see every single day, it takes out that litigation piece and people have agreed to have bring that decision. And people will say to me, and this is one of the biggest misconceptions, people will say to me, well, we don't want to like abdicate our parenting to some third party. I'm like, you already have a special master. It's called the judge, right? This is not meant to like abdicate your rights. Like if you could figure it out, then you would figure it out. And I tell people all the time, a lot of times having joint custody feels like having no custody, right? You can't get a decision. You can't get anything done. So if you want to get something done, sometimes having someone help can be helpful.
Yeah. And that's so true. And what's interesting is you're asking all these questions, I'm thinking, except for the people who just do it. So those are great individuals who are at least asking and trying to work together. But I think for a lot of people, it's really hard. I shouldn't have to ask for permission, but it's like, maybe you do. Or it's called trying to communicate, right? And move things forward for your children.
Well, if it's something that you share joint legal custody and you just do it, then at least there's a consequence or a person in there that can make a consequence for that. Because one of the biggest things I hear from people all the time is nobody holds him accountable. Nobody holds her accountable, right? So if you go and sign up for, you know, sleepaway camp, for the kid and I'm involved in it and I find out that's done without going through the proper channels, that's going to impact your ability to potentially make decisions later on. And also it stinks for the kids. Like I can't stand these cases of people signing people up for their kids up for extracurriculars going, well, I'm okay with them missing half the games or half the practices. That stinks for the kid. It stinks for the team, for the kid. It's not a good way for that to be done. That's not fair.
No, it's not. It isn't at all. Yeah, we're running out of time, but I did want to ask you this question because I think this is a great one. What do you see? Maybe I know there's a lot, but the top biggest mistakes you see parents make in written communication that really end up either, you know, getting them in court, referred to the special master. What are some big things they do that they should not?
Talk too much. They write too much. That's it. The more you say, the more gunk there is out there. Everybody knows Biff, or they should. If you haven't heard Biff before, good old Bill Eddy, brief, informative, friendly, firm. I love him. He's a mentor. He's a friend. read it, heed it. I also think right now, be careful of ChatGPT, because even though ChatGPT is a tool and a helpful tool, and maybe it makes things better, sometimes it's too wordy also, and it's usually too obvious.
Yeah.
So I think people write too much. And the other thing is that every single thing you write should have a purpose. If you can't answer the question, why am I sending this? Then don't send it. You need to be asking something or sharing something that is of meaning. It is not a vehicle to vent. Get a friend, get a therapist. It's not a place. And I tell people all the time, the criminal lawyer in me, everything you say can and
will be used against you. Again.
So if you don't want it on a declaration, don't say it.
Yes. Very true. That is great advice. It makes me think, because it's been years since I was a criminal attorney, but I got shirts for my two daughters at some legal conference that says, I invoke my right to remain silent or whatever, something like along those lines, which of course they talked all the time. You never get them to be quiet, but yeah, you should do that more often, right? You know, invoke your Fifth Amendment right to not answer that question. Yeah, it's true. Yeah. You got to be careful. It's all out there. To be used against you. Be careful.
Be careful what you post. Be careful, you know, do not talk to the police ever, ever, ever until you've talked to a lawyer. Do not, you know, same with DCFS. You can be really cooperative. I tell people, feel free to use my name in vain. I met this crazy lawyer, Robin, and she said that I shouldn't talk to anybody. Let me call her really quick. And then she says, it's okay. I'm happy to talk to you. That's a really good way to look cooperative and not be cooperative.
Yes, exactly. Well, Robin, before we go, because our show is called Women Winning Divorce, I would love for you to share, what does winning at life mean?
Oh, gosh, I think winning at life is having balance. I think having really good friends and people around you, and that could be family, but sometimes it's not family, right? I think just having support systems in place, finding joy, being grateful for things we have. We could always want more, and there's things that are always going to be shitty, but to be grateful for the things we have. And I think winning is being able to, you know, travel, eat well, do things, celebrate life. Don't live your life for your cases. Live your life for life.
Love it. I agree with you. Those are great. And lastly, Robin, where can our listeners find you for more information and resources?
So you can find me at dearcoparent.com. I also have an Instagram called dearcoparent. That's the best place to find me.
Wonderful. Well, we've reached the end of our show today. And thank you so much, Robin Sachs, for joining us to discuss when to involve DCFS or DCF, when not to, and protecting your children in high conflict situations and smarter ways to communicate with your co-parent. Thank you.
Listeners, if you or someone you know in the Northeast Florida area is going through or even thinking about divorce, you're not alone. Taking that first step can feel overwhelming. But it doesn't have to be. Our newsletter is filled with actionable advice tailored to guide you through this process. By signing up, you'll gain the tools to face the unknown with courage and see if we're the right fit to support you during this life-changing time. Don't wait. Click the link in the show notes, fill out the form, and take the first step toward building a brighter future today.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not an advertisement for legal services. The information provided on this podcast is not intended to be legal advice. If you have a legal issue, please contact an attorney in your local jurisdiction. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests are solely those of the individuals and do not represent the views or opinions of the firms or organizations with which they are affiliated. This podcast is available for private, non-commercial use only. Any editing, reproduction, or redistribution of this podcast for commercial use or monetary gain without the expressed written consent of the podcast's creator is prohibited.